Today, we're doing something a little different, namely having a conversation with the founder and CEO of England's largest watchmaking company. Stay tuned. Hello, friends. Pastor Tim Westermeyer here from St. Philip the Deacon in the western suburbs of Minneapolis. Good to be with you as always. For people familiar with this podcast, what we're doing today may not seem that unusual, but for folks who are hearing us for the first time, you may be thinking to yourself, why am I listening to a pastor in Minnesota talk to the CEO and founder of a British watchmaking company? And so there are a couple answers to that. One, for the last 20 plus years here at St. Philip the Deacon, we've been inviting people from all kinds of areas of expertise to come in and talk about what they do. So in some ways, this conversation is just an extension of that on a different platform. On another more personal level, and this is the one my listeners may be more familiar with, is a few things. One, I'm a huge Anglophile, so I love all things English and British. I'm also a huge fan of watches and watchmakers generally, which means that I'm a particular fan of one British watchmaking company named Christopher Ward. And so today, we're having a conversation with the CEO and founder of Christopher Ward, Mike France. Mike, thank you again for being with us. It's good to have you here.
It's my pleasure, Tim, and thank you for inviting me. We go back quite a way, don't we, really?
We do go back a ways, and yes, it's been a joy to sort of get to know you. I've been able to visit Maidenhead and visit with you personally at least once. I hope to get out to your new shop before too long. We'll see how that goes. I mentioned this lecture series or speaker series that I've been doing for more than 20 years. You had your own 20th anniversary, of course, in 2024. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And so I thought we would use this conversation as an opportunity to talk about sort of three things, the origins of Christopher Ward, some milestones along the way, and then let's call it the impact of the company to date. So as far as the origins go, one of the things that I deal with in my own life is, let's call it meaning and significance and purpose. You can correct me if I'm wrong about this, Mike, but my sense is that before founding Christopher Ward, you had been a very successful businessman and sold another company that had done very well. And what you discovered, and again, I'm going to invite you to put this in your own words, was that sitting on the beach and having an early retirement was maybe not all that you were supposed to do with your life. Is that a fair assessment?
Certainly is, Tim. I don't think I ever actually intended to retire. I was very lucky, having sold the educational toy business called Early Learning Centre, I was the CEO, and Peter Ellis, who is also a co-founder of Christopher Ward, he was the deputy CEO. We'd been lucky enough to, have a success there, and literally probably definitely didn't need to work again in the sense that we had enough money, more than sufficient to see out the rest of our lives and keep a roof over the family's head and groceries on the table. That was never going to be what we would do, or I would do, certainly. And after about a month of including a bit of time on the beach, recognizing within me that I actually believe we're here to be productive. I don't think it's just something that runs through one, and I'm sure you're the same. We're blessed to be sort of given faculties that enable things to happen. And so it was never going to be likely that I was going to retire. What I was going to do, however, was pretty unknown at that time, albeit we had created and we're talking, as you know, around 2004 here. We sold Early Learning Centre April 2004. What we'd managed to be able to do at Early Learning Centre was create a pretty large online business. We had 300 stores, we had a lot of franchises across the world, but we'd also created a pretty large online business back. We were an early adopter back in 96, 97. We set up the online part of Early Learning Centre. And we figured that that was likely to be the growth area for the future, even though back in 04, I mean, this is around about the time, I don't think Mr. Zuckerberg had actually set up, he was about to launch Facebook. Mm. People thought you weren't going to be able to sell anything much on the internet. Clothes, impossible to sell. And literally, when we decided to go into watches and become the first pure online player in luxury watches, which we were at the time, seems ridiculous and incredible now, but that was the case then. People, seriously intelligent people, and friends of mine as well, some of whom are seriously intelligent, believe it or believe it not, they were like, what are you even thinking about? Because you will never ever sell a single watch online. People will want to go and see those watches in the metal, they'll want to try them on their wrist. You can't possibly, you're deluded. Well, I probably am deluded, but the fact is that we'd been selling things like climbing frames online at Early Learning Centre. We kind of figured that if you could sell a climbing frame online, you could probably sell a watch. And we just had this sense that the future, what the big growth was going to come from the internet and online selling. So we decided that after a process of elimination of things that we were likely to want to be involved with, I mean, if you're going to devote time, attention, love to anything, best it's something that you are capable of loving. Yeah. especially if you don't need, and I mean, lots of people are not in as fortunate a position where they're able to choose. Mm. And possibly like you, Tim, I've never thought I've had a job ever. Mm. Whatever I've done, I've enjoyed. It's been not a job, it's been part of my life, it's been a joy. Mm. And that's a very fortunate place to be. I think not everybody has the luxury of that. But lucky as I was, I did have back in 04, as did Peter, as did Chris, who was the third leg of the stool at the time. Mm-hmm. We had the luxury of deciding what we wanted to do. We had no idea whether we'd be successful, but we chose watches because we all had a real interest in watches. Although I wouldn't count myself back in 04 as a serious collector, I was sort of into IWC in a reasonable way, and I had a few old Omegas. But I wasn't. It wasn't something that I was deeply knowledgeable about at all. Nor Chris nor Peter. But we had an interest and a liking for watches. And then we worked out that, well, actually, if you're going to be doing something on the internet and it's a new category on the internet, a pure play luxury watch brand, then, or whatever you're going to do, we wanted it to have global potential. We wanted it to be something that we could sell across the world. We wanted it, therefore, to be movable across the world with relative ease and low cost. So sofas were out. we weren't going to go into sofas, much as we liked lying on sofas. And we didn't want to be busy fools. In other words, we could have gone into, T-shirts. And we could have been churning out hundreds of thousands or millions of T-shirts, so we wanted it to be relatively high value, crossed with what do we like doing, what products do we like, what do we have a feel for, and watches popped up as something that pressed all of those buttons. So we decided on watches, knowing at the time absolutely literally nothing about the watch industry, but hey, that's part of the fun, isn't it? So we set off on this odyssey that has now lasted, as you said earlier, 20 years. Through quite a lot of hard work, some of it from us, a huge amount of luck, we've ended up as the UK's largest Watch Brand by some considerable distance. You know, we're now, I think, in the top 35 Swiss watch brands in the world, both in value and even higher in volume. So we've become something of interest to a number of people. And literally, I don't know that that was our idea or goal, but we're very grateful for it, that's for sure.
So related to the question of the origin story of the company, you've already discussed sort of the why you chose watches over sofas as an example. Drilling down into that more, you also made the decision that your watches would be Swiss made, which you wouldn't have had to make that decision, right? So talk a bit about that choice as you were developing the company.
Well, part of it, we were from the very beginning Swiss movement.
Yeah.
We originally were making our watches in China using genuine Swiss movements. Around and the first watches went on sale in June 2005, just two watches.
Mm-hmm.
Around about 2007, the Swatch Group, who are about a third of the luxury watch industry, they have a number of brands and they also own a number of component companies, the most important of which is a company called ETA, who you will know very well. ETA essentially supply the movements, the engines for mechanical watches in great number. The ETA 28242, which is a very famous workhorse movement, at that time, back in 07, was being provided by the Swatch Group to virtually every watch brand you and I could name. We found this an incredible situation, in actual fact, but this has been the situation that had been in existence for a long time in Switzerland. In 07, Old Man Hayek, who was the owner and chairman and chief exec of the Swatch Group, in his wisdom, let's call it that, he decided that that was no longer going to be the case. And that firstly, he was going to stop supplying any Swiss-made movements to China. Secondly, he was going to ultimately, within 2 or 3 years, stop supplying any of his movements to anybody. It's a slightly different story. The first part of it was we would no longer be able to get access to these really high quality Swiss movements. So we had a choice. Do we look at changing our movement supplier and going to Miyota, for instance, in Japan or anywhere else, or even Chinese movements? But we decided not to do that. We thought that the stamp of quality that Swiss had on the watch industry at the time was significant enough as a cut through for people to know that this is a good quality product, that we wanted to remain having Swiss movements, which meant we had to move out of China into Switzerland. So we literally booked some flights to Switzerland, hired a car and started touring around Switzerland, knocking on factory doors, trying to find somebody who would work with this tiny little British upstart brand who thought it was going to take on the might of the Swiss watch industry. And we were fortunate enough to find somebody who was either probably desperate enough to take us under their wing. He had access to ETA movements. So our manufacturing base moved from China to Switzerland. Ultimately, we discovered that his quality wasn't and his quality aspirations weren't quite our aspirations, so we moved away from our first supplier into a second supplier, and then literally had the good fortune, which again a piece of luck, we ended up bumping into Jörg Baeder, who had a company called Synergy Horlogere, who really got what we were trying to do, who similarly to us had a frustration with some of the idiosyncrasies of the Swiss watch industry approach, thought that we had something new and fresh to bring to the party. And so we decided we would effectively give our business to his company, And that was a key moment. That was in 08, early 09. And that was one of the key moments for the Christopher Ward business and brand, really.
Mm-hmm. So, and that connection to Jorg is no doubt one of the milestones. We'll get to those in a second. Before we get to those milestones, though, you've just spoken about the movements, the sort of engine of the watch being Swiss, and yet Christopher Ward is also an English or company, right, with a particular aesthetic, design aesthetic, right? So can you talk a bit before we get to the sort of milestones of the growth of Christopher Ward to what that means to you, what the British or English aesthetic design-wise coupled with the Swiss movements brings?
Of course. You're quite right. I mean, and we do describe ourselves as an English brand. Of course, we're British, but we describe ourselves as English, and anybody who's familiar with the United Kingdom will know that each of the parts of the United Kingdom have very singular aesthetics, have very singular cultures, lots of overlap, but there are distinctive differences. And one of the reasons that we elected to describe ourselves as an English brand is there is a, I suppose, an aesthetic associated with England that's gentler. If you think of Scotland, you think of ruggedness, you think of mountains, you think of not the rolling hills of England. It's our very first watches, as you know, were called Malverns.
Mm-hmm.
The Malvern Hills, which lie in the centre of England, are a gently rolling, beautiful range of hills, so much so that Edward Elgar, the famous English composer, was inspired by the Malvern Hills to write many of his most famous pieces of music, and we were inspired by the Malvern Hills to create the Malverns. And what we were looking for was that gentler aesthetic, with a little bit of humour wrapped in occasionally, because I suppose if England is known for anything at all these days, probably a sardonic, ironic humour is something that kind of goes with us a little bit. So we were always aware of taking what we do very, very seriously, but not taking ourselves too seriously, which is a quality I hope continues to run through the business. We take the business of watchmaking incredibly seriously. But I think, and I have to say, unlike some other parts of the watch industry itself, which is a very serious business in every single way, there ain't much humour there sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
And so this is a very English mix. We're the people, England is the people that gave you the Aston Martin and the Sex Pistols. You know, there's a sort of a real dichotomy going on. And we wanted to reflect that in the way we behaved, but also in the way we designed. If that's clear at all.
I love it. Okay, so let's move into some, again, this is your chance to reflect back on the last 20 years. I mean, as you do that, I imagine you can think of, well, probably many more than this, but we're going to limit it to, say, 3, 4, 5 watershed moments or milestones along the way that, as you look back, you think, yeah, that moment helped to make us who we are today. What are some of those that you think of?
Well, the very first one, and this really set us up in a way, was a piece of very good fortune we had given to us by a gentleman called Dave Malone. We'd taken some very early days, first few months of our trading life, we'd taken some advertising out in the Independent newspaper in the UK, where we described the watches we were selling. And somebody who knew about watches in the UK saw the ad, but his very good friend turned out to be a lecturer at the time, he's now a professor, but a lecturer at the time in the University of Tasmania, a chap called Dave Malone. And Dave was, we had no idea who Dave Malone was, but Dave was, at the time, was one of the key guys on timezone.com, which back in 05 was the world's biggest forum for watchers. Mm-hmm. There are many, many, many more of these now, but back to social media wasn't quite the thing back in 05 that it is today. Mm-hmm. And this guy decided to cut out the ad, sent it to Dave to say, look, these guys are shysters. These guys are conning people. They can't possibly produce this quality of watch at this selling price. I'm going to buy, can you get one, Dave? And can you post and expose these guys on timezone.com? So Dave Malone ordered a C5 Malvern automatic from us. And we unknowingly shipped it to Tasmania, obviously thinking we were beginning to cut through if people in Tasmania were aware of us. And to our eternal credit and to and benefit and to his eternal credit, I should say, Dave, when he saw the watch and he was experienced enough and knowledgeable enough to take the back off, there are markings on Swiss-made movements that indicate they are genuine Swiss-made movements. And he realized that this was a genuine ETA 28242. And instead of exposing us, he wrote them an incredible eulogizing piece. It's this long. Essentially, the headline, if I remember it correctly, was, I have discovered the best value mechanical watch the world has ever known. And that what that led to was, because he was an important, respected guy on Time Zone, people assumed that what he was telling them was correct. Mm. And so they started buying. I mean, we're not talking thousands of people, but we're talking suddenly we're sending watches all over the world. Mm. I assumed we were marketing geniuses. however, that was not the case. And it wasn't until the January of 06 when a second chap, a Dutch guy called Hans van Hoogstraten, called us to say, would you mind if I set up a forum on your behalf devoted to Chris Ford? And we went, well, why would you want to do that? He said, well, you must know about what's been going on timezone.com. Timezone.what? You know, no. He said, you're being talked about more than Rolex. No, well, what is Timezone? We didn't even know Timezone existed. He then said, well, look, you know, I've been thrown off. The guy who owned Time Zone at the time, a guy called Michael Sandler, who we obviously didn't know, but we got to know later on. Michael had assumed that we were paying these people, because after Dave had posted and all these other people, including Hans, started buying and then posting, Dave's right, these are fantastic watches, never seen better value anywhere. Michael Sandler assumed we were paying these people. It's called shilling in the world of internet, sure. Which is...
I worked for 10 years in public relations, yeah.
There you go. So, you know, as I understand it, it's a poker term. Mm. Hans was thrown off. He was so indignant because he knew we hadn't paid him. We hadn't even spoken to him until this moment. He was so indignant and so, I think, captured by what at least he thought we were trying to do. He decided to, right, I'm going to promote these guys. So he was in IT. He had his own IT business. And we said, well, you know, yeah, okay. Do you really want to? Yeah. He said, I'll pay for it. You don't pay me anything. I'm going to run it. It'll be on my servers. You don't have to do anything. And we said, well, okay. The only stipulation we have is that we have no editorial input, that people can post what the hell they like, good, bad, indifferent. It has to be straightforward, honest, transparent. Fine, he said. Today, that forum has thousands and thousands of members. It's one of the places people still go to learn the good, the bad, and the ugly about Christopher Ward. It's one of the places that we get most information about sometimes what we're doing right, but also what we're doing wrong, because it's far more interesting and important to know what perhaps you're not doing as well. They also have input into our collections. It's the most amazing receptacle, and it's all started from Dave Malone's post. So that was a pretty significant moment for us.
Okay.
And it led us to understand about this subterranean world that even back in 04, 05, 06 was beginning to develop amongst watch fans.
So we talked a little before we started recording about the Bel Canto, which of course comes much later. But maybe are there one or two other inflection points before that that come to mind?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've talked about bumping into York. So that was pretty important. And that led to, in 2014, a really significant moment for us when we merged the businesses. So we became this vertical watch brand. People will, or maybe they don't know, but Rolex is a vertical watch brand. There aren't that many.
Yeah.
But we now really had the opportunity of putting the customer directly in touch with the watchmaker within one brand. At the same time, we'd been working with York on our own movement for 4 years by this point, with his master watchmaker at the time, a genuine genius in my view, a guy called Johannes Janka, a very young, he was 27, 28 at the time, East German watchmaker. Often, in my experience, East Germany produces some of the finest engineers and finest watchmakers, largely, I think, because they didn't have the benefits that the West had whilst they were controlled from the Soviet Union. So they had cars that broke down all the time. So if they wanted to be able to drive to work, they had to fix their own cars. If they had clocks in the house, they had to repair clocks, etc. So if the washing machine broke, they had to repair it themselves because there weren't the opportunities and the service industries that we had become so accustomed to in the West. And so Johannes had become interested. He was obviously had an aptitude, but had a great interest. And he repaired his home's clocks, which led him into watches, which led him into working with some of the most famous watch brand, Langenzon. He was their master watchmaker for a while at 25, 26. Anyway, we managed to, York managed to get him into Chris Ward, or Synergy at the time. And he came because he bought into the fact that Chris Ford was trying to do something that the brands he'd worked for previously weren't trying to do, i.e. make wonderful watches accessible to as many people as possible without compromising on quality, but using the business model we had developed, which is a low-cost direct-to-consumer business model, to give those savings back to the consumer in the selling price of the product, thereby giving access to what you and I know is this wonderful visceral experience of owning and wearing a mechanical watch to as many people as possible. And he bought into that. He said to me, I remember very early on when I met him, that what he wanted to do was walk down the aisle of a plane and see some of his work on people's wrists. And working for Langenzon, you'd have to be walking down the centre of their safes. Because right. Mostly they're kept in safes. Yeah. So that was a critical part of creating what's now known as Calibre SH21, which is our own movement. And we launched that on July the 2nd, 2014, at the same time as we announced the merger with Synergy. And as I say, we'd worked on that movement for 4 years. Its genesis was back to old man Hayek, who determined he didn't want anybody to outside of his own company to utilize his movements in the future, which spawned a huge number of innovations from people like us, but bigger people than us, people like Breitling, Tudor. They all started thinking about, well, if we can't rely on the Swatch Group, we'll have to create our own movements. So the unintended consequence that Mr. Hayek created for himself was he created ultimately huge competition, which he hadn't intended to do. He'd hoped that he would destroy large chunks of the watch industry, but it created huge competition, and ultimately the competition authorities didn't allow him to make that decision. So it backfired on him in a big way. But in the meanwhile, we were able to create our own movement. Now, for a company of our size at the time, and still even today, and we're about to, in the next few months, announce a new movement, which is probably new news.
It is.
But this was unheard of.
Well, it was the first. I know it's Swiss made, but it was the first English movement made in how many years was it?
50 when we launched it. 50 years.
Yeah, 50 years. So a big deal.
Yeah, it was such a big deal that the then, and this is a wonderful little anecdote of the Swiss watch industry in some ways and our position in it, and what is. Before, York can't keep a secret, bless him. Basel World 2014, March, 3 months before we launched the movement, he's walking around Basel World with me and Peter, and in his pocket he's got an SH21. Walking towards us is the then CEO of Breitling, slightly bigger brand than us. Marginal.
Yes.
He knows him. They, Breitling were head officed in Grenken at the time, Jorg's from Grenken. Everybody in Switzerland knows everybody else in the watch industry anyway. Chat. Conspiratorially, come and have a look at this. Jorg has to show him SH21. And it wasn't just any old movement. This is a twin-barreled, COSC-certified, wonderful five-day power reserve movement. He's explaining this to this guy who's like, what the hell? What, this is your move? And what he actually said to us was, or to Jorg, who was showing it to him, was, what gives you the license to do that? And for me, that was one of the key moments because it said, well, the answer is we do. And that kind of, I suppose, arrogance or lack of humility or whatever it is, which is such anathema to us, but I think was certainly in that instance prevalent in the Washington, also said we'd arrived. We were beginning to get up their noses. We were beginning to be recognized, and it had a huge impact on how we were perceived. It didn't necessarily mean the sales went through the roof immediately as a result, but the perception within the industry of Chris Ward changed almost overnight once we launched SH21. So that would be one of the key moments.
Which is maybe a nice segue then. Let's move to the Belcanto. So you've talked about the time zone event, which increased your visibility, and then the SH21, which did the same. Yeah. Belcanto certainly did that. I was at Windup in 2022, and you were walking around with that in your pocket, showing it to a few people.
I can't keep a secret either.
I felt very fortunate to see it. But again, you can correct me if I'm wrong. From an outsider, I mean, someone who's a fan of the company, that watch was transformational.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for those in your audience who don't know about watches or us at all, and why would they? The Belcanto, which is Italian for beautiful singing, the name is apt because this is a watch that chimes on the hour every hour. And as you know, Tim, that's not an easy thing to achieve anyway. And it's quite a rare complication. But the way the team executed it made it a very beautiful watch as well, because we showed all of the important aspects of that watch above the dial, above the platine, as we call it in watchmaking, so that the key mechanisms that created the chime were visible as they worked. And the chime in the tone of D was important to us as well. We launched 300 as a limited edition. We had a backup 300 limited edition in a different colour, which we hadn't intended to launch until probably the April or the following May. The 300 went on sale. We knew we had a decent watch. I mean, and reactions from people like yourself, this before we launched it, when you saw it at Warner Brown, at Windup. We knew from the reactions of people like you and others that this was going to be a good watch, and we loved it. But you never know how people are going to. Well, those 300 sold out in 6 hours. Wow, that was unexpected. So we pulled forward the second 300 from the following May to the Friday after the Wednesday launch of the first one, and that sold out in 2 hours. And in addition to that, we had thousands of people who tried to buy it who were frustrated because now it's gone. So we decided, okay, let's see if we can do something that's never been done in the watch industry before, which is produce something of this complexity at around about 5,000 units per annum. And that had never been done. So we had to recreate a supply chain.
Right.
Which had its own issues and frustrations. We had to find new suppliers. We ended up buying into a CNC machinist supplier, state-of-the-art CNC machining. We had to build up a polishing company because a lot of the componentry is hand-polished, highly skilled. Takes hours. Each watch had about 6 to 8 hours just of hand polishing in it. There aren't that many hand polishers of that skill set in Switzerland, so we had to find them, train them up. It was a huge undertaking, but people still wanted Belcanto. And the response, most importantly from the customers, was quite astonishing and still is astonishing. We're now into the second iteration, third iteration, if you take account of the four colours we launched as a result of that supply chain improvement. But I suppose the most surprising consequence of us launching was the way in which the industry itself embraced the watch. And people who had never really looked at Chris Ward before were now looking at us in a different light. You know, some big figures in the industry were saying, this changes everything, not just for Chris Ward, but for the industry. It forces, in their view, it forced many other brands to rethink their value propositions. We're not supposed to be able to do this sort of thing at our level and deliver it at the price, but that's, I think a hope is just a natural consequence of where we started, you know, trying to put wonderful watches on the wrists of as many people as possible. So it created a huge stir and put us on the list of many collectors who probably had never even thought about Chris Ford before. And it also had the impact of raising the water level of the whole brand. So it wasn't just that watch that worked. We have many other fine watches, if I say so myself. And many of those watches had an uplift because people were looking at us in a different way. So that was a key moment for us. And as I say, you know, created its own problems. You know, last year we grew by 80%. And this is not it's a complex industry that, you know, there are, you know, creating a watch of that sophistication involves so many people, so many different skills, So many different opportunities, therefore, for it to not go quite right. And we have just one rule, that we will not compromise on the quality of our watches. Mm. So that led to, in some part, us delaying the delivery of watches to some people, which caused real heartache for us because it was causing heartache for customers. So there were understandable sort of customer service issues that came with it. But I think we will not just send out a watch. We want it to be right. We have a responsibility to us ourselves in that regard, never mind our customers. But we've overcome it. We've created a supply chain that didn't exist in the industry. And again, for a little, for somebody of our size, I love the fact that we're prepared to do that. I think it's you have to be quite brave, or maybe stupid, maybe a combination of the two. But you have to like a challenge, and I think that's one of the things that we do. The team here, they're at their best when they're at their most challenged.
Mm. Yeah. So let's move. I love this. All of those stories. Thank you. I want to talk just briefly about, let's call it, the impact to date of Christopher Ward. You've certainly spoke about that in some ways, the supply chain, the partnerships you have. We could talk about that, in my opinion, in lots of ways. We could talk about your 2% for Good, your partnership with Everton, the way you're training up a new generation of watchmakers. But maybe since this episode will come out a little before the second British Watchmakers Day, maybe we can focus on your, both Christopher Ward and you personally, your role in establishing the Alliance of British Watch and Clockmakers with Roger Smith. For people who don't know watches, he is, I'm going to call him the world's best watchmaker, right? But that's a big deal. And it strikes me, again, I'd like you to speak into this, that it demonstrates the fact that your posture towards the watch industry is one of cooperation and collaboration rather than competition. And it's created, you've spoken about the way you have helped build a different kind of structure for your own company, but you're now creating an entirely new platform for watchmakers throughout Britain. So I could talk a little bit about how the Alliance is transforming what has historically been a really important industry in England, and then went away for a while.
Went away for quite a long while. Firstly, to you guys, the Americans were the first to industrialize watchmaking. Where the Brits are pretty good at coming up with new ideas, and then pretty hopeless often of commercializing them. And at the turn of the last century, America was where it was at in terms of watches. Sadly for you guys, you also then allowed the Swiss to take it over. I suppose back to having a responsibility, which I think we have, for beyond our own walls, if you like. Roger Smith, who I would agree with you is arguably very much the world's finest watchmaker. This is a guy who makes watches literally from pieces of metal, every single component. He has a staff of about 15 now. They produce 15 watches a year, truly handcrafted in every single sense of the word. They're using lathes. It's incredible. If anybody ever has the chance of going to his workshop in the Isle of Man, they should take it. It's astonishing. One of my proudest moments, I suppose, since we started this business was becoming friends with Roger. He's a northern English lad like myself. But he's operating, you need half a million to start buying one of his watches, so he's in a slightly different bracket. He'd seen a watch of ours. It was an SH21 watch, and he sent me an email saying how fantastic he thought it was. He'd actually literally been to a show in London, Salon QP it was called. This would be 2014, 15. And I'd had a couple of conversations with him previously, but only en passant. And then he wrote this email, and I literally was running around the office. You know, this is real validation. This is like the greatest watchmaker in the world thinks we're doing a good job. Yeah!
Yeah.
That led to further conversations, and we used to meet up at every Salon QP. And then in 2018, I should say, Salon QP, November 2018, he and I were having a chat at the then, what turned out to be the last Salon QP, which we thought was awful. This wasn't just English watchmakers, but there was a very poor representation of English watchmaking in this international watch show. And yet he and I both believed and thought that there was a lot of stuff we were picking up by talking to people in the UK that were interested in developing their watch brands. And we just didn't think that any of that was being given a platform. So we determined on the first floor of Salon QP in November 2018 that we were going to do something about it. What was that going to be? By March the following year, 2019, we had determined that we were going to set up the Alliance of British Watch and Clockmakers, and that this was going to be a trade association that was literally going to do whatever it could to shine a light on British watchmaking. We didn't even know how many watchmakers were in the UK at the time. Nobody did. Nobody knew how big or small it was. Nobody knew how many people were involved. Anyway, we set off literally not being sure whether anybody would be interested in joining this thing. We were staggered that within 2 weeks we had 60 watchmaking companies join us. We now have well over 100 watchmakers. And the raison d'etre is entirely that. It's to give those incredibly ambitious, often really bright young watchmakers, sometimes bright old watchmakers, the opportunity to have their businesses and their brands and their watches brought to a much wider audience. And whatever Roger can do, and he's brilliant at this, and whatever small things we can do to help, we do. But the biggest thing that's been achieved is, you mentioned that I believe in, or at Chris Ward, we believe in collaboration and sharing information. What was most incredible is that there was this great hunger for all of these brands who didn't know often that there was anybody else in their own town or that was making. Suddenly there was a place that they could share information that was, and what was incredible to find was how openly that was being given and how welcome that was being received. And so you suddenly had this dialogue going on between disparate, sometimes completely opposite end of the market brands, but all of whom had this connection because they were British. And more than anything else, probably, that has stimulated the incredible growth that we're enjoying at the moment in British watchmaking. The physical, I mean, we launched it in COVID, which, you know, had its, as we all know, had its own limitations. So we were kind of restricted to online communication for a while. Last year, we launched the first British Watchmakers Day at Lindley Hall in Westminster, London. And again, 48 brands turned up, took space. About 15 of us produced limited editions just for the day. But wow, what a day. It was, honestly, Tim, it was, and I've been to many a watch show, as you know, and I know you have. Nobody, I've never experienced anything like it. The joie de vivre, the excitement. There were people queuing around the block to get in. It was just incredible. And in a way, that again has given another lift to the industry. So, you know, the aim is we want it to be a, you know, a $1 billion industry within, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 years. It's on a trajectory that can get us there. But moreover, I think it's just bringing a lot of joy into people's lives, whether they're makers or they're customers. And people are now collecting British watch brands. Right. So there's a subset of collecting going on, which is devoted to British watch brand. And then education, we're very close to launching some educational. What we're trying to do is make watchmaking in Britain a place where the best and the brightest want to come. So if you're going to grow, you're going to do it through people. You're going to do it through high quality people. You know, if people don't know there's an industry, and the British government, by the way, didn't know there was an industry at the time, then how are we going to attract the best and the brightest? So there are educational programs going on, there's PR programs going on. We're about to launch a really clever and well-designed careers hub for watchmakers and watch brands in the UK. It's so good that the French and I think ultimately the American watch industry might white label it to them, because it's a brilliant sort of piece of software that we've developed. So there's quite a lot of initiatives going on, but it's really the, whilst Roger and I set it up, the force is with the people themselves, the watchmakers themselves. They've picked this up, run with it, and they've made it some, you know, the sum of the parts is huge now, and it's exciting.
This is not, despite what people may think, it's not a sponsored video. However, if people, and I am a proud member, I'm not a manufacturer, but I'm a member from, gosh, 2022 is when I joined, so member number 494. If people want to support all of the wonderful initiatives you just talked about, and I know the show is sold out, but if people even here in the States want to support it, where would they go to support the Alliance?
Go to the website, britishwatchmakers.com. And so you can sign up there. It's a relatively small amount of money in pounds sterling. It's around £50. Actually, the benefits include free magazines, etc. Actually outweigh the cost, but also it gives access to tickets for things like British Watchmakers Day, but also first access to special limited editions. We, in collaboration with Fears, another British watch brand, last year brought out the Alliance 001. We'll launch this Alliance 002 in collaboration, Chris Ward in collaboration with another watch brand this year. The first one was 50 pieces sold out in 3 minutes. So, and therefore you can only buy it if you're a member.
Right, right. Excellent.
So if you're really into collecting, join.
All right. So we talked about going 30 minutes. We've gone about an hour. So for the sake of our listeners,
My apologies.
Oh, heavens. It's delightful. But why don't we wrap it up? Mike, any final thoughts? I've got a ton of other questions, but maybe we'll do that in episode 2 or 3. But any final thoughts before we sign off here from you, or lessons learned over 20 years?
Well, I suppose the biggest lesson I've learned is that there are always lessons to learn. You know, it's every day, this industry, this business of watchmaking brings something new to learn. And if you ever think you've cracked it, that's probably the day to get out. So we keep learning, we keep making mistakes. And I say to the guys, if you're not making mistakes, you're not trying hard enough. Hopefully we don't make too many of the big ones, but I think the biggest lesson is be curious, keep trying to learn, because there's so much to learn. So much to learn.
Good. Well, as you know, you have a pastor here in Minnesota that's cheering you on. I'm sorry I can't get to the British Watchmakers Day this year, but in the future, and I hope to get to Maidenhead before too long. By the way, Patrick, who's in the background, thank you for helping out getting this all coordinated. Mike, thanks for spending some time with me and everyone else. You were going to say?
Well, I'm just going to say it's always a pleasure, Tim. And you are always welcome here, as you know, and your family.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity of talking to you guys.
Well, and thanks for your time. And to all of you out there, thanks for joining us. And as always, be well, stay in touch, and God bless.